Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to Treasures from Malta, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balzan, an art historian and an artist with a long connection with Patrimonio. I'll be presenting this podcast and meeting some of Malta's living treasures. These treasures are artists, historians or art collectors with some Malta connection. They're all fair game for the pod and we want to share them with you. My guest today is a musician and music researcher whose eyes fire up with incredible excitement whenever she talks about the discoveries she keeps making in our many rich historic archives here in Malta. Through the decades, she has discovered musicians and musical instrument makers from the past. She has uncovered and played long-forgotten sheet music, and she's pieced together much of Malta's rich ethnographic music history. She has lectured extensively at the university and delivered many public presentations. She has formed a musical ensemble to promote Malta's musical heritage, both locally and in performances overseas. And she's published books on Maltese music history that have become landmark studies in the discipline. She has also curated exhibitions on musical instruments, the most recent being the major Fondazione Patrimonio Malti exhibition, Music in Malta, From Prehistory to Vinyl, which was held in 2019, as well as publishing myriad articles, papers and studies that continue to build on our previously sketchy knowledge of the musical legacy of Malta. Anna Borch-Cardona, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Francesca. Thank you so much for asking me. Always a pleasure meeting you.
Anna, do you recall when your love of music started and what triggered it off?
Yes, it was my mum, actually. My mum played the piano. She was an LRSM. And she was first to start teaching me at the age of six. And from then on, you know, I couldn't go on with piano lessons with her because my twin brothers were born and they were quite a handful. So then I went on to the Bachettas, who were well-known music teachers at the time, and continued my studies there.
And on and on and on.
And on and on, yes.
You never stopped, actually. I mean, music has really featured in all of your life since.
Yes, always.
More recently, in 2018, you obtained your PhD in music from the University of Southampton. What was your doctoral research about and why was it important for the history of music in Malta?
Yes, it was about musical culture in 17th century Malta. And the focus was an instrument maker who lived in St. Ursula Street and had his bottega in St. Ursula Street in Valletta. So we see it through his inventory, you know, his connection with music and life in 17th century Malta. Everything comes out through his inventory and through knowledge of this one person. It's incredible how much we get from him.
And so, there's nothing like this information that had been published before.
Yes, I found it very exciting, obviously. I wouldn't have done it all those years studying this person. But also the musical culture at the time. So much comes out.
But you're also interested in dance history connected to Malta. Is it traditional dance that you're specifically interested in, sort of dance of the people? Or does this interest extend also to what I would say is high art, that is dances that were performed in theatres for the elite of the time?
Yes, they are actually two sides of one coin, you know, the traditional and the high art. So, yes, I am interested in both because the two constantly influence one another over the years. You can often see it. At the moment, in fact, I'm working on dance music of upper society, composed by Maltese composers, but for the enjoyment of that section of society. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I'm interested in both. Everything that makes up music culture in Malta, and dance cannot exist without music.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to find a lot of dance music.
In fact, you have published as well about dance, how it's represented even in prints, the prints we have at Palazzo Falso and the Balli di Sfesania. So linked to your publications, you've published your research in several different publications, including Treasures of Malta. But in 2014, you published Musical Instruments of the Maltese Islands, History, Folkways, and Traditions. And this was a major publication, a book that you published with Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. What was the book about, and why would we consider it a landmark publication in the history of music in Malta?
Okay, I had long wished that Malta could have its own traditional instruments recorded as other countries did. You know, there's Italy, Greece, I've seen them all. And I really wish that we could do our own. So that was, to me, something very important. It, obviously, many years in the making. It wasn't something done overnight. Endless interviews and archival research. But yes, it's a landmark publication for that reason. Mm-hmm. It has put Malta's organology, which is the study of musical instruments, on the map, I think. And otherwise, people wouldn't know about Malta's musical instruments.
Well, in fact, you are so connected with very prestigious foreign societies, and in fact, you have contributed studies, other studies, even before this book. And these foreign societies are dedicated to the study of music, like the Galpin Society. Is there anything about Maltese ethnographic music or musical instruments that is completely unique to Malta and that kind of distinguishes our music from the music of any other society?
Yes, good question. We are a mixture of cultures here, so there's influences coming from everywhere. But I would say that our ana, our folk singing, is unique in itself. Even though there are influences and you can see the influences, but what we've produced is our own. Mm-hmm. It's different and it's our own. Mm-hmm. And as far as instruments go, I think the za, I would pick that, the bagpipe, the Maltese bagpipe, known as the za, which is also unique. Again, there are resemblances, but nothing exactly like it.
Can you describe it?
Yes. It is a very crude type of bagpipe. It looks very primitive. It has the complete skin of a calf or a dog or a goat. Complete skin minus the head. In other words, there are the legs, there's the tail, and the fur on the outside. And most cultures have eliminated much of that. You don't see the legs. You don't see the fur. You know, you hardly ever see the tail. So ours seems to have kept all these elements of the animal. Mm-hmm. And to me, it looks like we've given a new voice to the animal. Mm. It's just got a new voice, but all its characteristics are still there. We've added a chanter.
Sorry.
We added a chanter on which to play on, so it's got another voice. So to me, that is something very primitive, and it was so important to the last maker that I knew. Unfortunately, we didn't have much of a choice, because the last maker was Tony Kaki Alhammarum, mm-hmm. and to him, it was so important to have the legs and to have that tail and the fur.
Did he say why? Is it an aesthetic choice? Or
no, to him, it was so important. He doesn't say why. But it's something very important. You have to have it. Mm-hmm. And the body is stiff, not malleable, like other bagpipes.
And how is it played, Anna?
Right. So to the skin is added a chanter, which is pieces of cane, right, which have finger holes and a horn at the end. And those are played, you blow through one of the legs, mm-hmm. right? There's a pipe through one of the legs, yeah. And you play on the finger holes, right? You blow through it and play on it. So, yes, and it's a bagpipe, but a very primitive type of backpipe. I don't like using the word primitive, actually, but very, it hasn't changed much.
Mm-hmm. So elements of even chemistry get in, go into it in terms of the preservation of the skins and the fur and everything.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I looked into the way it was being preserved, how it was done with lime, very important, and blown up, and to make sure that it remained stiff, looking like the animal. You know, there's so much importance given to it, looking like the animal.
Not for the faint-hearted, I would say. You say you're giving new life to the animal by blowing, by giving him a voice. I see it from a very different point of view, and I'm thinking, not for the faint-hearted. I wouldn't like to be blowing into his leg.
And that is the problem about it, that because people have looked at it in that way, it's been shunned. You know, so that is the bit. But I think it's so important that we try to keep these elements, because they're you don't find them anywhere else.
Are there many that survive?
Backpipes?
Or of these type? Because obviously they are, in time, they're possibly going to decompose
they're
as well.
They're obviously going to deteriorate, and decompose. Not many have survived in the way that they were made. More are being made differently now. In other words, it's not a stiff bag anymore. It's a soft bag. You don't necessarily have all the four legs and tail. So I think there's quite a lot of change. The chanter has remained the same.
That indicates the absolute necessity of preserving at least a few examples of our maroons intact.
Definitely. Yes. I have one which was made by him. In my presence, we made it together. And I have also made my own in the same way. So, yes.
And were you successful?
Right. Yes.
Talking about objects that are becoming rare, you frequently publicly appeal for people to contact you if they find pieces of music amongst old papers in their collection, especially in collections which are about to be thrown out of the house. What are you hoping to find?
Okay, now, first of all, I have been working on Maltese music printing. So I'm looking at cataloguing as much as possible of this music. Right, but what worries me is that ever since we started recycling, we feel not only no problem, we probably feel good about putting things into a green bag and disposing of them because they're going to be made into something else. But what it means for this music is that it's mulched and lost forever. So that's why I'm always making this appeal. Please don't throw away your music. You know, don't throw it away. Now, usually what happens is a house is being cleaned up and everything's thrown out, including music. And that's part of our paper heritage. You have to realize that anything, it's not only music, it's other things that are just thrown away.
Have you made any lucky finds?
Not many, I have to admit, but yes, but there are things, not exactly what I'm looking for, but it's always music. I always find something. Like, for example, I'm interested in the stamping on the music. So if there's the stamp of a shop in Malta, I know it was sold in that shop, you know, around the periods. So everything is important, even if it's not the music I'm looking for, that I do find a lot of. So I know who was selling what kind of music was being sold, in 1910 or earlier in the 1890s. I know exactly what was being sold. So people don't realize that. It's just a simple thing. But yes, it tells us a lot about the history of music, the sales of music in Malta.
Yes.
We didn't have that many shops, so they all have their stamp. You know, the Fabi, the Lancellotti, the Brizzi, the Lucia, and you know who was selling what.
And this is backed up in the 19th century with newspapers, for example, and their adverts. The music shops are contained within the adverts. It's interesting because you're looking at music very widely. You're looking at the context of how music was played, how it was consumed, if you like, and how people were taught as well, even in the homes. I mean, not necessarily professionally played music, but just the context of 19th century Malta earlier and beyond, I presume, as well.
Yes.
And in fact, my next question was really about how your research goes beyond strictly music history. And for me, it takes on an almost anthropological dimension at times. For example, I find fascinating how you connect sound with ancient superstitions. I'll give you a very concrete example. When we were collaborating, you and I, way back in 2009 on the Whistles exhibition that we held at Palazzo Falson, which yes. you curated. Yes. That was great fun. You had explained to me how sound makers were held to turn away the devil and to keep evil at bay. And therefore, whistles and rattles, which are sound makers, but they're also, in a way, musical instruments, they are appropriate for babies, to, not only to entertain them, but to protect them from supernatural forces, because sound will keep the devil away. Now, are there other instances where music takes on more relevance in a society other than just its aesthetic value?
Okay. Sound and supernatural forces. I mean, if you look at sacred music, I think we're looking at connecting with the divine. There's already something there, but mm-hmm. you're asking something else. Sound was generally, the world over, considered to alienate evil forces. And that's why sound instruments best exemplify this fighting off evil, evil forces. What we have in the cittadella, the bell we have from 1639 in the cittadella, now it's been taken down. But it actually specifically said, I expel demons and calm the storms. So it's the evil forces are being sent away. Mm-hmm. Right? So you're expelling them. And also, danger is being expelled, like storms or anything that is dangerous to man is expelled by sound.
And it's also an attempt to control natural forces, which is obviously we know to be impossible. And yet man has also always tried to exert a force on things which are going to affect his life and his society.
Yes, but it was always the gods are sending, so, you know, even in pagan times you had this. They had a god for everything, for the sea, for the wind, for the sky, right? There was the same
for
thing.
For music, of course.
Music as well, yes. Music and dance, they went together. Yes, so this has continued, but not in an obvious way like it was in these instruments. Ratchets during Holy Week, for example, the sound of ratchets. That's what their function was, purification. And bells are actually purification. So there's so much, yes. And babies were also protected in many ways by these rattles, which had pellet bells, whistles. They had everything combined. Shaking, you know, the shaker inside. There's everything combined. Sound to protect the baby.
And I would add, even the material of which they were made, sometimes they had handles of coral, and coral is similarly considered in the Mediterranean to turn away the devil and to protect.
Exactly. That's what it's all about. Mm-hmm.
Anna, you mentioned Holy Week traditions and the ratchet. You've written about grinding Judas bones in connection with the Cholaita. Can you elaborate a bit about that?
Yes, I think I've just said actually that their sound was meant to expel the demons and to purify the place during Holy Week, especially. People believed they had different beliefs in the sound of this Cholaita. That went on and on over the years. I mean, some places they stopped using them and have started again.
Can we describe the Cholaita? Because it comes in a manual format in the sense that you can actually hold it in your hand, but it can go on all the way to a huge instrument.
There are small instruments which, like the football ratchet, everybody knows. Mm-hmm. Football ratchet, for example, is one. But there are simple clappers, bits of wood that flap against each other. Mm-hmm. Those are just handheld. But then inside, up in the belfries, there are large ones that are meant to be heard around the villages. So you get huge crosses with hammers in between, which are rotated and make a huge sound. There are very large ratchets, which also are used up in the belfry. All of them with the same purpose. Obviously, we forget all this. It just becomes part of, you don't use the bells, but you use these. Actually, the bells and these instruments all have the same function.
What is the connection with Judas? Why is it grinding Judas' bones?
Okay, yes. And that goes back again to times when the Jews were thought, especially Judas, was placed up there as the person who killed Jesus. Because of him, Jesus died. So he was blamed for it. Mm-hmm. This is not the way it's looked at anymore, but that's the way it was. So you can see why they are using this ratchet, grinding his bones, literally, the sound of grinding his bones. It's to alienate the person who committed the evil. And it's all connected. You are getting rid of the evil.
And is it still held to be the grinding of Judas' bones tradition amongst,
I never hear
villages?
I never hear it described as that, mm-hmm. but in the 19th century it was.
I see. All right. So the sound produced by the lighter, by this big ratchet, was referred to as grinding Judas' bones.
To grinding his jaw, or to the soldiers coming together. It's all... approaching Jesus, and you know what happens after that. You know, mm-hmm. it's the death of Jesus. So it's all the evil that's approaching. Mm-hmm. It's either the soldiers approaching or Judas, or the connotations are all there.
Mm-hmm. Now, your father, Dr. George Zamit Mempel, has been a fundamental influence on your life. In a nutshell, yeah. Could you just describe his research interests, his discoveries, and his career?
Yes, my father was a doctor, first of all, but he was always researching. I always remember him, after office hours, call them what you will, because there was no time. He'd be out day and night. But then he would spend his time in his study, and he was always researching. Now, his interests were medical history and folklore of medicine and fossils. Or paleontology, and the history of fossils and history of paleontology, and the folklore of fossils. So, I mean, it's obvious I get my history and folklore from there. Definitely over the years, it must have been an influence. Like about, for example, the shark's teeth that he wrote about as a safeguard against poisoning. You know, and things like that. Yeah, I was always fascinated by this part of his research. I was never really interested in the actual fossil, but into the folklore of the fossils and the folklore of medicine, yes.
Was there any overlap, actually? Were there any fossils or at least shells that were used in musical instruments?
In Malta... Not really, only the bronia, the large conch shell. We do have shells which were used as necklaces in prehistory, which, who knows, because definitely when you moved about with a string of shells, they would have rattled. So, yes.
that brings me into the story.
The jewelry of prehistory.
Exactly. Yeah. Ironically, I got to know your father before I did you, because I had, of course, come knocking on his door to discuss the little bit of overlap there was between his research interests and mine, which was jewelry, of course. And we discussed serpent's eyes, and he had made some fundamental studies which were really useful for the history of jewelry, like the shark's teeth, the Lingua di San Paolo, which were fossilized shark's teeth, which, as you rightly said, were held to prevent somebody being poisoned. In the presence of poison, it would protect, it would sweat, or it would protect the person and alert the person that there was poison in his cup. And now, over the last decade or so, you have been helping him organize his research. Can you tell me a bit about this process and how do you decide how to organize such a varied amount of material and information?
No, I didn't really organize his information. He had been working on several topics throughout his life, but he never finished certain things, right? So what I helped him with mostly was, for example, there was the illustrations of Maltese fossils. I got the photos together. He had everything, but nothing was digitized, for example. Mm-hmm. So I had to digitize all his photographs, put them together, see where they're going to fit in. He had everything typed, by the way. Everything was, you know, typewriter. Okay, he got his computer, but so I had to organize all that. But the material, the knowledge is his, not mine. So I only helped him with the with organizing them. Yes, exactly.
Fantastic. And in that way, you familiarize yourself with the material as well.
Yes, I suppose so.
And ahead of this podcast recording, I asked you to pick a favorite piece of music to play during the break. Let's go for the break and let's listen to it. Episode originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, music historian Anna Borch-Cardona. And we're back. Don't forget to go to our podcast page on www.patrimonio.org to see pictures and links to what we've discussed in each podcast episode. Anna, what is the music we have just listened to?
Okay, that is an Anna melody, which is used in our folk singing. There are several melodies, not that many, but there are melodies which are used over and over again, unlike many other cultures where you've got a new melody every time. We tend to use the same melodies and give a different text. Mm-hmm. Now, this happens with the Anna Spirito Pront, with the ballads, it happens all the time. Generally, it is recycled melodies. And this is one of them. This is one of the melodies that is used for recitation of mostly ballads. For example, if you think of other cultures, I mean, if you think of a song, you're immediately thinking of its title and its melody. Mm-hmm. Whereas with us, it's different. The melody is retained and the text is changed.
It was played by Giocolari Ensemble. When did you establish the group? And what was the reason for it?
Yes, yes. Now, the group was established in 2002, which is the year that I had published my book, A Musical Legacy. Mm-hmm. So this was meant to record the music that I had found and which I had published in the book. That's how the group was formed. Now, a lot of the music was collected by Edward Jones, who was harper to the Prince of Wales. He played the harp, he taught the harp, so they were written for harp. And that's why the harp was brought into the group in the first place. Mm-hmm. And we've kept the harp in the group.
One of the hallmarks of your group is that you actually dress up in period costume and you also explain quite a bit. Anna, whenever I've sat in on a concert, you have always tried to explain the historical context of the music that you're about to play.
Yes, that is exactly what I always wanted the group to be about. The costumes are not important. They came and went. And we've sometimes worn them and sometimes not. But the the explaining, putting the music we're playing into its context is something that I am, you know, very, very, something that's important to me.
Piano is your primary musical instrument. However, you do play a number of other instruments. Which are they?
In the group, I am mainly the researcher and I do the transcriptions, okay? But I will never play the piano, for example, because I think if I were to play the piano now, you know, I used to practice so much, but now the practice has gone. So I don't play the piano, but what I play usually are things like tambourine, friction drum, flauta, things like that, the Maltese instruments. But my main thing is the research and putting the concert into the, you know, putting it together and putting it all within that context. There's usually a theme going through it. And I also like to connect the place we're performing with the music we're playing very often.
The music historian almost takes over the musician in
you. Yes, it does.
Now, you've recorded a number of CDs based on the research and discoveries that you made in early music of Malta. Can you briefly run us through these discoveries?
Okay, the first CD was Musical Legacy to go with the book. Mm-hmm. Now, in that, for example, there were knights' dances dating back to the 16th century, and they were called the Branle de Malte, something that was danced by French knights. Now, Prof. Switinger had a lot to do with this first, my publication, not so much with the CD, but with the publication. He wanted me to publish the music he had found. I think he found them in Oxford. And he wanted me to publish them. So I said, yeah, but I'll put them with some other things that I have found, put them all together. And that's what I did. Now he found part of the dances, but then I went on looking for other parts. They were separated. Mm-hmm. There were parts in England, parts in France, and I tried to put these dances together. So then what we performed were the combination of parts which were put together. It's all based on a lot of research, a lot in different libraries in the world.
That's remarkable that you managed to piece them together from different countries,
yes,
and different archives.
It's not easy, yes, but we managed to put them together anyway. Mm-hmm. Then there was also the Edward Jones collection. Now, Edward Jones never came to Malta, but he published a lot of airs and dances from different countries, among them Malta. He must have got them from somewhere. It must have been easy for him to get them. He was Harper to the Prince of Wales, so he's got a lot of connections. Mm-hmm. So somebody would have come to Malta and he obtained them for him, most likely. So there was a lot of work to be done on those pieces. And I found two books. One was published in 1807, Maltese Airs and National Airs and Dances, mostly based on carnival dances. The other one was Terpsichore's Banquet. Again, you've got dances, the god of dance, Terpsichore. And you've got marches, for example, mm-hmm, and Pyrrhic dances, which were sword dances used in carnival as well. So there's a lot of material, masked ball dances, contradanze, Maltese contradanze. But he's doing this with different countries. There are a whole lot of other publications of his. He was doing this with music from different cultures, which is interesting at the time. We're talking about the beginning of the 19th century, end of 18th, beginning of 19th century. There was this interest in the different cultures. So that's what we did in Musical Legacy. In Dotli Da'a, it was divided differently into the different parts of the year, different seasons. We had Christmas, a music that went with Christmas, with the New Year, with Carnival, weddings, the workplace, women, for example, lullaby, and the pounding of the roof, which was a woman's job at the time, and melodies connected with the sea. Mm-hmm. So we had all that put together in one exemplifying Malta's folk music.
Anna, I have a few questions stemming from all this. First of all, you mentioned dances. Do we know what dance steps accompanied this music?
If we come to the knights' dances, which I mentioned from the 16th century, we do. It's a pity they haven't been danced, because there is a dance manual which actually describes one of them in detail with the dance steps. There are actually five dances, but one of them is there in detail. So why couldn't a choreographer put them together and, you know, we could dance them in the manual, for goodness sake. I imagine them, you know, beautifully danced over there. They were men and women. They were in Turkish costumes, very lavish. Can you imagine the
fantastic. Yeah,
it would be so fantastic. It would be fantastic. I always hoped somebody would be interested in doing that.
It could happen. It could happen in future.
It might happen. So, yes, there are the steps. When it comes to Maltese dances, no. We have forgotten everything. We've let everything slip away. Mm-hmm. That is all I can say. Everything has slipped away. So we have descriptions, but they're not enough. Mm-hmm. They don't give you enough.
You can't possibly recreate them. But when it comes to music, was it difficult to interpret and play this music if it didn't, it hadn't come down to us in sound form, or it was an altered sound form?
No. Yes, it's very possible. First of all, the minute that music is written down, it's probably going to lose something. If it's like, for example, how would you put down what you heard from an Anne, when he's got all those fluctuations and melismas, how they didn't put them down. Mm-hmm. So everything was clean. Mm-hmm. So that's something you take into consideration. Can't be helped. That's, you know, it's what we've got then. That's all we've got. So we have to work on what there is. No, it's not always easy.
In fact, I have to link it up also with, you've edited 17th century music manuscripts, which were discovered in the cathedral archives. I mean, what did this entail, and how sure can you be that you were accurate to the sound that the composer intended?
For that, since there is notation written down and there's a way of transcribing it, which you have to learn, obviously, I think we're closer to what, because that's what the composer wrote, and so we are much closer than if something is a traditional piece, was heard by somebody, put down. So in that case, yes, you learn how to do it. It's much more difficult. It's not straightforward like you seeing a 19th century bit of music writing. It's it's more complicated, far more complex, but I think that there's always decisions that, as an editor, you have to make.
Yeah.
But the important thing is, and that's how those were done, that whenever you do something that is uncertain, or you can't read a note, for example, you're not sure and you think it might be that, you put it in square brackets and you know that it's the editor's decision, and it's not, you know, definite. And, you know, if somebody else comes along and thinks otherwise, he can change it. But in that case, perhaps it's easier.
Absolutely. Now, some years ago, you were invited to curate Music in Malta from Prehistory to Vinyl, which was Fondazione Patrimonio Malti's major exhibition on musical instruments. That actually was a survey of music from prehistoric times to the 20th century. Yes. Now, that exhibition was held at the Cathedral Museum in Indina in 2019, and it met with acclaim, as it was not only visually beautiful, but it also gave viewers a new experience because of the use of cutting-edge technology, which kind of enabled them to transition seamlessly from one area to another, with a soundtrack which really reflected what they were seeing, even in terms of the evolution of music, to match the objects that were being seen on display. Can you describe your role in this exhibition?
In the exhibition, I was curating it. So it obviously presupposes previous awareness of instruments that there are available on the island to start off with. Mm-hmm. Then you obviously have to plan which instruments are to be included in this exhibition and which are not. You have to decide how they are going to be presented and what kind of story we're going to be telling, in what order. Are we going to use chronology or, you know, what? So that all had to be decided. Then there's the research of each and every instrument, which is a lot of work, each and every one. You have to plan and write up all the captions and all the text on the boards, right, and ensure that they are correctly done. And then I also have to do, for example, the narration, which is something we didn't have in previous exhibitions. Mm-hmm. All the narration had to be done, written out exactly, for the audio, which was a lovely experience, you know, as you going along and you can actually just listen through the audio as you go along the exhibition. Mm-hmm. And then you also have to ensure that instruments are all safely exhibited.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
So, yes.
So, not to mention the publication Not to mention the publication that accompanies the exhibition.
Which then there was a publication, of course.
A formidable contribution as well.
Yes.
Was there any particular exhibit that stood out from the rest for you? I mean, perhaps the rarest piece or the one that you didn't think you would be able to pull off in the sense that you could loan it for the exhibition and you manage or...
Yes, there was some. There are several instruments I could say, you know, that were favorites. But I'm going to pick one, which was, I wasn't sure we would be able to get it because of its size and its weight. But we did. And this was the second century tombstone of a young Greek comedian and musician.
Amazing.
Which to me was so, so important. His name was Aelius Hermolaos. Mm-hmm. And this it dates to the Roman period. So you've got a Greek young man who ends up in Malta during the Roman period. And you get this. He's playing a Greek-style instrument, a lyre. And not only doesn't it say on the tombstone that he's playing the lyre, but it's also depicted. So we can see the instrument, which is something very rare. In not many places do you find the name and the actual instrument depicted. Sometimes you have to guess what the instrument was. You know, in this case, we've got it. We've got it there. So this is really amazing. To me, it was a very important piece of an artifact that it's not an instrument, but it's an artifact that tells us so much. It shows how Greco-Roman musical and theatrical culture had reached the island. Talking about the second century.
From a curatorial point of view, there are the headaches of transportation because
this was a nightmare, I can tell you, yes.
Let's not forget that the exhibition was held on the first floor of the museum. Yes. It was even at ground floor level.
Exactly.
And it must have weighed a ton.
Yes, exactly how much I don't remember, but yes, I think you're getting pretty close.
And this came from the National Collection, I believe.
Yes, it did. It came from the National Collection, Heritage Malta, in the Archaeology Museum.
And made of limestone?
Yes, it's made of limestone. It's carved in limestone.
Fantastic. I remember it was one of the earlier rooms, obviously, because the exhibition was organized chronologically. But Anna, you are a collector and a museum director in your own right. Now tell us a bit about the Anna Borch Cardona Music Museum. What is the main focus of the collection?
Right. I get rather worried when you talk about the museum, but it is more of a virtual museum than anything else. In other words, it's not a museum that is open to the public, but there are obviously... I've collected several instruments, but not only instruments. They include everything that pertains to Malta and to the Mediterranean, where I need to compare things. So I've got also comparative instruments where you can see influences. So those are important to me. It also includes, for example, sheet music, which is... printed music, to me that's important. What were people learning? What were people playing? What? Mm-hmm. It's all important. Everything ties up. Anna chapbooks. Mm-hmm. There were these
what are chapbooks?
Booklets. They were little booklets which were printed, mm-hmm. Which contained Anna text only, obviously. Mm-hmm. Just the, which were published by Anneia and circulated so that people could know, you know, what they were singing. It would be a story about something. Sometimes it was, for example, the death of somebody or the murder of somebody. Mm-hmm. Anything dramatic, you may be sure, was put into folk song.
I would imagine these chapbooks are very ephemeral. They were printed for a very exactly. limited audience, and then exactly. probably a lot of them get thrown out with time.
Now, when I talk about our paper heritage, you see, these are also very precious, which, again, are likely to be thrown away. Mm-hmm. So, yes, so anything like that, I do collect, yes. And I obviously can't exhibit all this.
But you do exhibit them in a digital format, so on your website.
But in a digital format, I've got my blog site, mm-hmm. which is called the Anna Bojkardona Music Museum, mm-hmm. abcmusicmuseum.blogspot.com, which you can visit. But there, every now and then, I put something up when I have the time. Mm-hmm. So, yes, and it's from my own collections usually.
How do you see your museum growing, and what are your long-term intentions for it?
Now, my dream is to see a proper museum in Malta, a museum of music, where it's not just a showroom of instruments, but where you could have performances, where you could also have a library, for example, where, you know, people could go and everything. This is the dream. This yeah. is the dream. But, I need to work on it more, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I really wish that we could have it. And I know that we could.
Well, you need institutional support for such a big dream because,
of course. Of course.
You know, a large building and space for performances yes. and all that.
And also, you have to have the right temperature, the right humidity, mm-hmm. a lot of things that go into it.
So. Of course, all that organic material, all the instruments are yes. made of organic material, most of them are. Mm-hmm. But you've also curated the Malta section of the Musical Instrument Museum in Phoenix, in Arizona, in the U.S. How did that come about, and why their interest in faraway Malta?
Yes, you're right. Now, there was this American, what would you call it, shop chain, Target.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know the one.
American, yes, exactly. They're a huge chain of shops. And Target decided, in other words, the boss of Target, a huge businessman, decided that he wanted to put his money into a museum in Arizona where there's very little else. So that's what he did. And this museum was created where they wanted representative instruments from around the globe, mm-hmm. which is a huge undertaking. Right then I was contacted by a musicologist who knew me, and he said, could you help us in this? And I said, okay. And I did, and eventually sent over some of Malta's that we could anyway, guitars mm-hmm. and a za'. And a few other things, tambourines and a friction drum. So we sent representatives there of our
folk music more than anything.
Of our folk music, yes, yes.
Because
yes.
that distinguishes us, I suppose, from other nearby yes. societies like Sicily.
You can also, once you've got them all there together, you can also compare things, which is mm-hmm. nice. I also send them all the literature and the, you know, for each instrument. So, and sadly, the person who made the guitars was Crispin from Hazabar. Mm-hmm. He made those guitars. He just passed away now.
How wonderful that what he has produced is now yes. enshrined in a museum for exactly. posterity.
Yes.
And
yes,
for
yes.
an international audience.
Very much so.
Is there anything comparable? I mean, like, for example, the Horniman Museum of Musical Instruments, is it comparable to this museum, or is this museum in Arizona even more ambitious in its capture?
It is more ambitious. The Horniman, for example, has fantastic, you know, instruments there. They've got instruments also from several parts of the world. Mm-hmm. There were people who collected and left their instruments there. In fact, Horniman, that's what it is, actually. It came from a collector. The instruments came from a collector. Mm-hmm. There were also missionaries who brought instruments back, and they've got that sort of thing, which is mm-hmm. very interesting. Yes.
But they're not attempting to represent all the instruments over the world.
No. And that is a huge, huge undertaking. Yeah. And I can't, but they did it. They did, you know, as close as possible. They got as many instruments as they could from all over the world.
And finally, Anna, although you seem to have done it all, I can't imagine that you're not busy planning yet another project. What's in the works for you, Anna?
No doubt. Right. At the moment, I am publishing what started off as my thesis. So that should be out soon. 17th century musical culture and my Matteo Morales, who was the instrument builder. So that's now happening soon. The next project is the Mozart's music printing in the 19th century, which I'm working on. So that's next.
So those are publications, books.
These are publications, mm-hmm. yes. And not only, and the concert, and, you know, I've tied it up with quite a whole project. It's a whole project.
Mm-hmm. Next year is your 20th anniversary of Giocolari.
Yes, exactly. I know.
So we look forward. The trouble
is that COVID came in the way, you know, and it's stopped us a little, but... Yeah, hopefully. And we've started rehearsing again, so yeah, we should be back.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Anna, I'm going to close off here to let you get back to your musical instruments and research and all your varied interests. Thank you so much for your time. It's been fascinating catching up with you. As always, your discoveries and your research just fires me up with enthusiasm to go and do my own research. And I think it happens to many of our listeners as well. Thank you for contributing so much to the musical legacy of Malta.
Thank you, Francesca.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website under the podcast section. That's www.patrimonio.org.